did not accompany you to the monastery. No. And Tom is dead. So we only have your word for it, that Tom said this to you. Your story cannot be verified. How much verification do you want? She said spiritedly. Jack saw the abandoned baby. Francis picked it up. Jack and I met Tom and Alfred and Martha. Francis took the baby to the priory. Tom and I spied on the priory. How many witnesses would satisfy you? I don't believe you, Walleran said. You don't believe me, Ellen said. And suddenly Philip could see she was angry, deeply and passionately angry. You don't believe me. You, Walleran Bygod, whom I know to be a perjurer. What on earth was coming now? Philip had a premonition of cataclysm. Walleran had blanched. There's something more here, Philip thought, something Walleran is afraid of. He felt an excited fluttering in his belly. Walleran had a vulnerable look all of a sudden. Philip said to Ellen, How do you know the bishop to be a perjurer? 47 years ago, in this very priory, there was a prisoner called Jack Cherbourg, Ellen said. Walleran interrupted her. This court isn't interested in events that took place so long ago. Philip said, Yes, it is. The accusation against me refers to an alleged act of fornication 35 years ago, my lord bishop. You have demanded that I prove my innocence. The court will now expect no less of you. He turned to Ellen. Continue. No one knew why he was a prisoner, least of all himself. But the time came when he was set free and given a jeweled cup, perhaps as recompense for the years he had been unjustly confined. He didn't want a jeweled cup, of course. He had no use for it, and it was too precious to be sold at a market. He left it behind, in the old cathedral, here at Kingsbridge. Soon afterward he was arrested by Walleran Bygod, who was then a plain country priest, humble but ambitious, and the cup mysteriously reappeared in Jack's bag. Jack Cherbourg was falsely accused of stealing the cup. He was convicted on the oaths of 3 people, Walleran Bygod, Percy Hamley, and Prior James of Kingsbridge, and he was hanged. There was a moment's stunned silence. Then Philip said, How do you know all this? I was Jack Cherbourg's only friend, and he was the father of my son, Jack Jackson, the master builder of this cathedral. There was uproar. Walleran and Peter were both trying to speak at the same time, but neither could be heard over the astonished hubbub of the assembled clergymen. They came to see a showdown, Philip thought, but they never expected this. Eventually, Peter made himself heard. Why would 3 law-abiding citizens conspire to falsely accuse an innocent stranger? He said skeptically. For gain, Ellen said. Walleran Bygod was made an archdeacon. Percy was given the manor of Hamley and several other villages, and became a man of property. I don't know what reward was received by Prior James. I can answer that, said a new voice. Philip looked around, startled. The speaker was Remigius. He was well past his 70th year, white-haired and inclined to ramble when he talked. But now, as he stood up with the help of a walking stick, his eyes were bright and his expression alert. It was rare to hear him speak publicly. Since his downfall and return to the monastery, he had lived a quiet and humble life. Philip wondered what was coming. Whose side was Remigius going to take? Would he seize a last opportunity to stab his old enemy Philip in the back? I can tell you what reward Prior James received, Remigius said. The priory was given the villages of Northwold, Southwold, and Hundred Acre, plus the forest of Old Dean. Philip was aghast. Could it be true that the old prior had given false testimony under oath for the sake of a few villages? Prior James was never a good manager, Remigius went on. The priory was in difficulty, and he thought the extra income would help us out. Remigius paused, then said incisively, It did little good, and much harm. The income was useful for a while, but Prior James never recovered his self-respect. Listening to Remigius, Philip recalled the stooped, defeated air of the old prior, and at last understood it. Remigius said, James had not actually perjured himself, for he swore only that the cup belonged to the priory. But he knew Jack Sherburg was innocent, yet he remained silent. He regretted that silence for the rest of his life. He would, Philip thought. It was such a venal sin for a monk. Remigius's testimony confirmed Ellen's story and condemned Walleran. Remigius was still speaking. A few of the older ones here today will remember what the priory was like 40 years ago. Run down, penniless, decrepit, demoralized. That was because of the weight of guilt hanging over the prior. When he was dying, he finally confessed his sin to me. I wanted... Remigius broke off. The church was silent, waiting. The old man sighed and resumed. I wanted to take over his position and repair the damage. But God chose another man for that task. He paused again and his old face worked painfully as he struggled to finish. I should say, God chose a better man. He sat down abruptly. Philip was shocked, bemused, and grateful. Two old enemies, Ellen and Remigius, had rescued him. The revelation of these ancient secrets made him feel as if he had been living with one eye closed. Bishop Walleran was livid with rage. He must have felt sure he was safe after all these years. He was leaning over Peter, speaking into the archdeacon's ear, while a buzz of comment rose from the audience. Peter stood up and shouted, "Silence!" The church went quiet. "The court is closed," he said. "Wait a minute." It was Jack Jackson. "That's not good enough," he said passionately. "I want to know why." Ignoring Jack, Peter walked toward the door that led into the cloisters, and Walleran followed him. Jack went after them. "Why did you do it?" he shouted at Walleran. "You lied on oath, and a man died. Are you going to walk out of here without another word?" Walleran looked straight ahead, white-faced, tight-lipped, his expression a mask of suppressed rage. As he went through the door, Jack yelled, "Answer me, you lying, corrupt, worthless coward! Why did you kill my father?" Walleran walked out of the church, and the door slammed behind him. Chapter 18. The letter from King Henry arrived while the monks were in chapter. Jack had built a big new chapter house to accommodate the 150 monks, the largest number in a single monastery in all England. The round building had a stone-vaulted ceiling and tiers of steps for the monks to sit on. Monastic officers sat on stone benches around the walls, a little above the level of the rest, and Philip and Jonathan had carved stone thrones against the wall opposite the door. A young monk was reading the 7th chapter of the Rule of St. Benedict. The 6th step of humility is reached when a monk is content with all that is mean and vile. Philip realized he did not know the name of the monk who was reading. Was that because he was getting old, or because the monastery was so big? The 7th step of humility is reached when a man not only confesses with his tongue that he is most lowly and inferior to others, but in his inmost heart believes so. Philip knew he had not yet reached that stage of humility. He had achieved a great deal in his 62 years, and he had achieved it through courage and determination and the use of his brain, and he needed to remind himself constantly that the real reason for his success was that he had enjoyed the help of God, without which all his efforts would have come to nothing. Beside him, Jonathan shifted restlessly. Jonathan had even more trouble with the virtue of humility than Philip did. Arrogance was the vice of good leaders. Jonathan was ready to take over the priory now, and he was impatient. He had been talking to Aliena, and he was eager to try out her farming techniques, such as ploughing with horses and planting spring crops of peas and oats on part of the fallow land. I was just the same about raising sheep for wool 35 years ago, Philip thought. He knew he should step down and let Jonathan take over as prior. He himself should spend his declining years in prayer and meditation. It was a course he had often prescribed for others. But now that he was old enough to retire, the prospect appalled him. His constitution was as sound as a bell, and his mind was as lively as ever. A life of prayer and meditation would drive him mad. However, Jonathan would not wait forever. God had given him the skills to run a major monastery, and he was not planning to waste his talents. He had visited numerous abbeys over the years and made a good impression wherever he went. One of these days, when an abbot died, the monks would ask Jonathan to stand for election, and it would be hard for Philip to refuse permission. The young monk, whose name Philip could not remember, was just finishing the chapter when there was a knock on the door, and the gatekeeper came in. Brother Stephen, the circiter, frowned at him. He was not supposed to disturb the monks in chapter. The circiter was responsible for discipline, and like all such men, Stephen was a stickler for the rules. The gatekeeper said in a loud whisper, "There's a messenger from the king." Philip said to Jonathan, "See to it, would you?" The messenger would insist on handing his letter to a senior monastic officer. Jonathan went out. The monks were all whispering to one another. Philip said firmly, "We will continue with the necrology." As the prayers for the dead began, he wondered what the second King Henry had to say to Kingsbridge Priory. It was not likely to be good news. Henry had been at loggerheads with the church for 6 long years. The quarrel had started over the jurisdiction of ecclesiastical courts, but the wilfulness of the king and the zeal of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Becket, had prevented compromise, and a dispute had grown into a crisis. Becket had been forced into exile. Sadly, the English church was not unanimous in supporting him. Bishops, such as Waller and Bigod, took the king's side in order to gain royal favour. However, the Pope was putting pressure on Henry to make peace with Becket. Perhaps the worst consequence of the whole dispute was that Henry's need for support within the English church gave power-hungry bishops such as Waller and greater influence at court. That was why a letter from the king was even more ominous than usual to Philip. Jonathan returned and handed Philip a roll of vellum fastened with wax, the wax impressed with the mark of an enormous royal seal. All the monks were looking. Philip decided it was too much to ask them to concentrate on praying for dead people when he had such a letter in his hand. "All right," he said. "We'll continue the prayers later." He broke the seal and opened the letter. He glanced at the salutation, then handed the letter to Jonathan, whose young eyes were better. "Read it to us, please." After the usual greetings, the king wrote, "As the new Bishop of Lincoln, I have nominated Waller and Bigod, currently Bishop of Kingsbridge." Jonathan's voice was drowned by the buzz of comment. Philip shook his head disgustedly. Walleran had lost all credibility locally since the revelations at the trial of Philip. There was no way he could continue as bishop, so he had persuaded the king to nominate him Bishop of Lincoln, one of the richest bishoprics in the world. Lincoln was the third most important diocese in the kingdom after Canterbury and York. From there it was only a short step to an archbishopric. Henry might even be grooming Walleran to take over from Thomas Becket. The thought of Walleran as Archbishop of Canterbury, leader of the English Church, was so appalling that Philip felt sick with fear. When the monks calmed down, Jonathan resumed, "And I have recommended the Dean and Chapter of Lincoln to elect him." Well, that was easier said than done, Philip thought. A royal recommendation was almost an order, but not quite. If the chapter at Lincoln took against Walleran, or if they had a candidate of their own, they would give the king trouble. The king would probably get his way in the end, but it was not a foregone conclusion. Jonathan went on, "I order you, the chapter of the Priory of Kingsbridge, to hold an election for the new Bishop of Kingsbridge, and I recommend you to elect as bishop my servant Peter of Wareham, Archdeacon of Canterbury." A collective shout of protest went up from the assembled monks. Philip went cold with horror. The arrogant, resentful, self-righteous Archdeacon Peter was the king's choice as the new Bishop of Kingsbridge. Peter was exactly the same type as Walleran. Both men were genuinely pious and God-fearing, but had no sense of their own fallibility, so they saw their own wishes as God's will, and pursued their aims with utter ruthlessness in consequence. With Peter as bishop, Jonathan would spend his life as prior battling for justice and decency in a county ruled with an iron fist by a man with no heart, and if Walleran became archbishop, there would be no prospect of relief. Philip saw a long, dark age ahead, like the worst period of the Civil War, when earls of William's type did as they pleased while arrogant priests neglected their people and the priory shrank once again to an impoverished and enfeebled shadow of its former self. The thought angered him. He was not the only angry one. Stephen Cercetus stood up red-faced and shouted, "It shall not be!" at the top of his voice, despite Philip's rule that, in chapter, everyone must speak calmly and quietly. The monks cheered, but Jonathan proved his wisdom by asking the crucial question, "What can we do?" Bernard Kitchener, fat as ever, said, "We must refuse the king's request." Several monks voiced their agreement. Stephen said, "We should write to the king, saying we will elect whom we please." After a moment he added sheepishly, "With God's guidance, of course." Jonathan said, "I don't agree that we should refuse point blank. The quicker we are to defy the king, the sooner we will bring his wrath down on our heads." Philip said, "Jonathan is right. A man who loses a battle with his king may be forgiven, but a man who wins such a battle is doomed." Stephen burst out, "But you're just giving in!" Philip was as worried and fearful as all the others, but he had to appear calm. "Stephen, be temperate, please," he said. "We must fight against this awful appointment, of course. But we will do it carefully and cleverly, always avoiding open confrontation." Stephen said, "But what are you going to do?" "I'm not sure," Philip said. He had been despondent at first, but now he was beginning to feel aggressive. He had fought this battle over and over again all his life. He had fought it here in the priory, when he defeated Remigius and became prior. He had fought it in the county, against William Hamley and Walleran Bygod, and now he was going to fight it nationally. He was going to take on the king. "I think I'll have to go to France," he said, "to see Archbishop Thomas Becket." In every other crisis throughout his life, Philip had been able to come up with a plan. Whenever he or his priory or his town had been threatened by the forces of lawlessness and savagery, he had thought of some form of defense or counterattack. He had not always been sure of success, but he had never been at a loss to know what to do, until now. He was still baffled when he arrived at the city of Sens, southeast of Paris, in the Kingdom of France. The cathedral at Sens was the widest building he had ever seen. The nave had to be 50 feet across. By comparison with Kingsbridge Cathedral, Sens gave an impression of space rather than light. Travelling through France for the first time in his life, he had realized there were more varieties of church in the world than he had previously imagined, and he understood the revolutionary effect travel had had on Jack Jackson's thinking. Philip made sure to visit the Abbey Church of Saint-Denis when he passed through Paris, and he had seen where Jack got some of his ideas. He had also seen two churches with flying buttresses like those at Kingsbridge. Obviously, other master masons had been confronted with the problem Jack had faced, and had come up with the same solution. Philip went to pay his respects to the Archbishop of Sens, William Whitehands, a brilliant young clergyman who was the nephew of the late King Stephen. Archbishop William invited Philip to dinner. Philip was flattered, but he declined the invitation. He had come a long way to see Thomas Becket, and now that he was so close he was impatient. After attending Mass in the cathedral, he followed the River Yonne, northward, out of the town. He was travelling light for the prior of one of the wealthiest monasteries in England. He had with him only 2 men-at-arms for protection, a young monk called Michael of Bristol as his aide, and a pack-horse loaded with holy books, copied and beautifully illustrated in the scriptorium at Kingsbridge, to use as gifts for the abbots and bishops he called on during the journey. The costly books made impressive presents and contrasted sharply with the modesty of Philip's entourage. This was deliberate. He wanted people to respect the priory, not the prior. Just outside the north gate of Sens, in a sunny meadow by the river, he found the venerable Abbey of Saint-Colombe, where Archbishop Thomas had been living for the past 3 years. One of Thomas's priests greeted him warmly, called servants to take care of his horses and baggage, and ushered him into the guest house, where the archbishop was staying. It occurred to Philip that the exiles must be glad to receive visitors from home, not just for sentimental reasons, but because it was a sign of support. Philip and his aide were given food and wine and introduced to Thomas's household. His men were all priests, mostly young and, Philip thought, rather clever. Within a short while Michael was arguing with one of them about transubstantiation. Philip sipped a cup of wine and listened without taking part. Eventually one of the priests said to him, "What's your view, Father Philip? You haven't said anything yet." Philip smiled. "Knotty theological questions are the least worrying of problems to me." "Why?" "Because they will all be resolved in the hereafter, and meanwhile they can safely be shelved." "Well spoken," said a new voice, and Philip looked up to see Archbishop Thomas of Canterbury. He was immediately aware of being in the presence of a remarkable man. Thomas was tall, slender, and exceptionally handsome, with a wide forehead, bright eyes, fair skin, and dark hair. He was about 10 years younger than Philip, around 50 or 51. Despite his misfortunes, he had a lively, cheerful expression. He was, Philip saw instantly, a very attractive man, and this partly explained his remarkable rise from humble beginnings. Philip knelt and kissed his hand. Thomas said, "I'm so glad to make your acquaintance. I've always wanted to visit Kingsbridge. I've heard so much about your priory and the marvellous new cathedral." Philip was charmed and flattered. He said, "I've come to see you because everything we've achieved has been put in peril by the king." "I want to hear all about it, right away," Thomas said. "Come into my chamber." He turned around and swept out. Philip followed, feeling at once pleased and apprehensive. Thomas led him into a smaller room. There was a costly leather and wood bed, covered with fine linen sheets and an embroidered quilt, but Philip also saw a thin mattress rolled up in a corner, and he recalled stories that Thomas never used the luxurious furniture provided by his hosts. Remembering his own comfortable bed in Kingsbridge, Philip suffered a pang of guilt to think that he snored in comfort, while the primate of all England slept on the floor. "Speaking of cathedrals," said Thomas, "what did you think of Sens?"
"Amazing," Philip said. "Who's the master builder?"
"William of Sens. I'm hoping to lure him to Canterbury one day." "Sit down. Tell me what's happening in Kingsbridge." Philip told Thomas about Bishop Walleran and Archdeacon Peter. Thomas appeared deeply interested in everything Philip said, and asked several perceptive questions. As well as charm, he had brains. He had needed both to rise to a position from which he could frustrate the will of one of the strongest kings England had ever had. Underneath his archbishop's robes, it was rumoured, Thomas wore a hair shirt, and beneath that charming exterior, Philip reminded himself, there was a will of iron. When Philip had finished his story, Thomas looked grave.
"This must not be allowed to happen," he said.
"Indeed," Philip said.
Thomas's firm tone was encouraging.
"Can you stop it?"
"Only if I'm restored to Canterbury." This was not the answer Philip had been hoping for.
"But can't you write to the Pope, even now?"
"I will," Thomas said, "today. The Pope will not recognize Peter as Bishop of Kingsbridge, I promise you. But we can't stop him from sitting in the bishop's palace, and we can't appoint another man." Philip was shocked and demoralized by the decisiveness of Thomas's negative. All the way here he had nursed the hope that Thomas would do what he had failed to do, and come up with a way to frustrate Walleran's scheme. But the brilliant Thomas was also stumped. All he could offer was the hope that he would be reinstated at Canterbury. Then, of course, he would have the power to veto episcopal appointments. Philip said dejectedly, "Is there any hope you'll come back soon?"
"Some hope, if you're an optimist," Thomas replied. "The Pope has devised a peace treaty which he urges me and Henry to agree to. The terms are acceptable to me. The treaty gives me what I've been campaigning for. Henry says it is acceptable to him. I have insisted that he demonstrate his sincerity by giving me the kiss of peace. He refuses." As he spoke, Thomas's voice changed. The natural rise and fall of conversation flattened out and became an insistent monotone. All the vivacity went out of his face, and he took on the look of a priest delivering a sermon on self-denial to a heedless congregation. Philip saw in his expression the stubbornness and pride that had kept him fighting all these years. "The refusal of the kiss is a sign that he plans to lure me back to England and then renege on the terms of the agreement." Philip nodded. The kiss of peace, which was part of the ritual of the Mass, was the symbol of trust, and no contract, from a wedding to a truce, was complete without it. "What can I do?" he said, as much to himself as to Thomas. "Go back to England and campaign for me," Thomas said. "Write letters to your fellow priors and abbots. Send a delegation from Kingsbridge to the Pope. Petition the King. Preach sermons in your famous cathedral, telling the people of the county that their most senior priest has been spurned by their king." Philip nodded. He was going to do nothing of the kind. Thomas was telling him to line up with the opposition to the king. That might do Thomas's morale some good, but it would achieve nothing for Kingsbridge. Philip had a better idea. If Henry and Thomas were this close, it might not take much to push them together. Perhaps, Philip thought hopefully, there was something he could do. The idea excited his optimism. It was a long shot, but he had nothing to lose. After all, they were only arguing about a kiss. Philip was shocked to see how his brother had aged. Francis's hair was grey. There were leathery bags under his eyes, and the skin of his face looked desiccated. However, he was 60 years old, so perhaps it was not surprising. And he was bright-eyed and sprightly. Philip realized that what was bothering him was his own age. As always, seeing his brother made him aware of how he himself must have aged. He had not looked in a mirror for years. He wondered if he had bags under his eyes. He touched his face. It was hard to tell. "What's Henry like to work for?" Philip asked, curious, as everyone was, to know what kings were like in private. "Better than Maud," Francis said. "She was cleverer, but too devious. Henry is very open. You always know what he's thinking." They were sitting in the cloisters of a monastery at Bayeux, where Philip was staying. King Henry's court was billeted nearby. Francis was still working for Henry, as he had for the last 20 years. He was now head of the Chancery, the office that wrote out all the royal letters and charters. It was an important and powerful post. Philip said, "Open? Henry? Archbishop Thomas doesn't think so." "Yet another major error of judgment on Thomas's part," Francis said scornfully. Philip thought Francis ought not to be so contemptuous of the Archbishop. "Thomas is a great man," he said. "Thomas wants to be king," Francis snapped. "And Henry seems to want to be Archbishop," Philip rejoined. They glared at one another for a moment. "If we're having a row already," Philip thought, "it's no surprise that Henry and Thomas are fighting so fiercely." He smiled and said, "Well, you and I shouldn't quarrel about it anyway." Francis's face softened. "No, of course not. Remember, this dispute has been the plague of my life for 6 years now. I can't be as detached about it as you." Philip nodded. "But why won't Henry accept the Pope's peace plan?"
"He will," Francis said. "We're a whisker away from reconciliation, but Thomas wants more. He's insisting on the kiss of peace."
"But if the king is sincere, surely he should give the kiss of peace as a surety."
Francis raised his voice.
"It's not in the plan," he said in an exasperated tone. "But why not give it anyway?" Philip argued.
Francis sighed.
"He would, gladly. But he once swore an oath in public never to give Thomas the kiss of peace."
"Plenty of kings have broken oaths," Philip argued. weak kings. Henry won't go back on a public oath. That's the kind of thing that makes him different from the wretched King Stephen.
Then the church probably shouldn't try to persuade him otherwise, Philip conceded reluctantly.
So why is Thomas so insistent on the kiss?
Francis said in an exasperated tone.
Because he doesn't trust Henry. What is to stop Henry from reneging on the deal? What could Thomas do about it? Go into exile again? His supporters have been staunch, but they're weary. Thomas can't go through all this again. So before he yields, he must have iron guarantees.
Francis shook his head sadly. It's become a question of pride now, though, he said.
I know Henry has no intention of double-crossing Thomas, but he won't be compelled. He hates to feel coerced.
It's the same with Thomas, I think, Philip said. He's asked for this token, and he can't back down. He shook his head wearily. He had thought that Francis might be able to suggest a way to bring the two men together, but the task looked impossible.
The irony of the whole thing is that Henry would gladly kiss Thomas after they're reconciled, Francis said. He just won't accept it as a precondition.
Did he say that? Said Philip.
Yes, but that changes everything, Philip said excitedly.
What did he say, exactly?
He said, I'll kiss his mouth, I'll kiss his feet, and I'll hear him say Mass after he comes back.
I heard him myself. I'm going to tell Thomas this.
Do you think he might accept that?
Francis said eagerly.
I don't know.
Philip hardly dared to hope. It seems such a small climb down. He gets the kiss, it's just a little later than he wanted it.
And for Henry? A similar, small climb down, Francis said with rising excitement. He gives the kiss, but voluntarily, rather than under compulsion.
By God, it might work.
They could have a reconciliation at Canterbury. The whole agreement could be announced in advance, so that neither of them could change things at the last minute. Thomas could say Mass, and Henry could give him the kiss, there, in the cathedral. And then, he thought, Thomas could block Walleran's evil plans.
I'm going to propose this to the king, Francis said, and I to Thomas. The monastery bell rang. The two brothers stood up.
Be persuasive, Philip said. If this works, Thomas can return to Canterbury, and if Thomas comes back, Walleran, by God, is finished.
They met in a pretty meadow on the bank of a river at the frontier between Normandy and the Kingdom of France, near the towns of Fréteval and Vieville-le-Ray. King Henry was already there with his entourage when Thomas arrived with Archbishop William of Sens. Philip, in Thomas's party, spotted his brother Francis with the king on the far side of the field. Henry and Thomas had reached agreement, in theory. Both had accepted the compromise whereby the kiss of peace would be given at a reconciliation mass after Becket returned to England. However, the deal was not done until the two of them had met. Thomas rode out to the middle of the field, leaving his people behind, and Henry did the same, while everyone looked on with bated breath. They talked for hours. Nobody else could hear what was being said, but everyone could guess. They were talking about Henry's offences against the church, the way the English bishops had disobeyed Thomas, the controversial constitutions of Clarendon, Thomas's exile, the role of the Pope. Initially, Philip was afraid they would quarrel bitterly and part worse enemies. They had been close to agreement before, and had met like this. And then something had come up, some point that touched the pride of one or both, so that they had exchanged harsh words and then stormed off, each blaming the intransigence of the other. But the longer they talked, the more optimistic Philip became. If one of them had been ready to storm off, it would surely have happened early on, he felt. The hot summer afternoon began to cool, and the shadows of the elms lengthened across the river. The tension was unbearable. Then, at last, something happened. Thomas moved. Was he going to ride away? No, he was dismounting. What did it mean? Philip watched breathlessly. Thomas got off his horse, approached Henry, and knelt at the king's feet. The king dismounted and embraced Thomas. The courtiers on both sides cheered and threw their hats into the air. Philip felt tears come to his eyes.
The conflict had been resolved by reason and goodwill. This was how things ought to be. Perhaps it was an omen for the future. 2. It was Christmas Day, and the king was in a rage. William Hamley was frightened. He had known only one person with a temper like King Henry's, and that was his mother. Henry was almost as terrifying as she. He was an intimidating man anyway, with his broad shoulders and deep chest and huge head. But when he was angry, his blue-gray eyes became bloodshot, his freckled face went red, and his customary restlessness turned into the furious pacing of a captive bear. They were at Bourg-le-Roi, a hunting lodge of Henry's, in a park near the Normandy coast. Henry should have been happy. He liked to hunt better than anything else in the world, and this was one of his favorite places. But he was furious, and the reason was Archbishop Thomas of Canterbury. "Thomas! Thomas! Thomas! That's all I hear from you pestilential prelates! Thomas is doing this. Thomas is doing that. Thomas insulted you. Thomas was unjust to you. I'm sick of Thomas!" William furtively scrutinized the faces of the earls, bishops, and other dignitaries around the Christmas dinner table in the great hall. Most of them looked nervous. Only one had a look of contentment, Walleran Bigod. Walleran had predicted that Henry would soon quarrel with Thomas again. Thomas had won too decisively, he said. The Pope's peace plan forced the king to yield too much, and there would be further rows as Thomas tried to collect on the royal promises. But Walleran had not simply sat back to wait and see what would happen. He had worked hard to make his prediction come true. With William's help, Walleran constantly brought Henry complaints about what Thomas had been doing since he returned to England, riding around the countryside with an army of knights, visiting his cronies and cooking up any number of treacherous schemes, and punishing clergymen who had supported the king during the exile. Walleran embroidered these reports before passing them on to the king, but there was some truth in everything he said. However, he was fanning the flames of a fire that was already burning well. All those who had deserted Thomas during the 6 years of the quarrel, and were now living in fear of retribution, were keen to vilify him to the king. So Walleran looked happy while Henry raged. And well he might. He stood to suffer more than most from the return of Thomas. The Archbishop had refused to endorse the nomination of Walleran as Bishop of Lincoln. Nevertheless, Thomas had come up with his own nominee as Bishop of Kingsbridge, Prior Philip. If Thomas had his way, Walleran would lose Kingsbridge but would not gain Lincoln. He would be ruined. William's own position would suffer too. With Aliena acting as Earl, Walleran gone, Philip as Bishop, and no doubt Jonathan as Prior of Kingsbridge, William would be isolated without a single ally in the county. That was why he had joined Walleran at the royal court, to collaborate in the undermining of the shaky concord between King Henry and Archbishop Thomas. Nobody had eaten much of the swans, geese, peacocks, and ducks on the table. William, who normally ate and drank heartily, was nibbling bread and sipping posset, a drink made with milk, beer, eggs, and nutmeg, to calm his bilious stomach. Henry had been driven into his current fury by the news that Thomas had sent a delegation to Tours, where Pope Alexander was, to complain that Henry had not kept his part of the peace treaty. One of the king's older counsellors, Anjouguet de Bohun, said, "There will be no peace until you have Thomas executed." William was shocked. Henry roared, "That's right!" It was clear to William that Henry had taken the remark as an expression of pessimism, rather than as a serious proposal. However, William had a feeling that Anjouguet had not said it lightly. William Malvoisin said idly, "When I was in Rome on my way back from Jerusalem, I heard tell of a pope that had been executed for insupportable insolence. Damned if I can think of his name now." The Archbishop of York said, "It looks as if there's nothing else to be done with Thomas. While he's alive, he will foment sedition at home and abroad." To William, those three statements sounded orchestrated. He looked at Walleran. At that moment, Walleran spoke. There is certainly no point in appealing to Thomas's sense of decency.
Be quiet, the lot of you!
The king roared. I've heard enough. All you do is complain. When will you get off your backsides and do something about it? He took a gulp of ale from his goblet.
This beer tastes like piss!
He shouted furiously. He pushed back his chair, and as everyone hastened to stand, he got up and stormed out of the room. In the anxious silence that followed, Walleran said, "The message could hardly be clearer, my lords. We are to get up off our seats and do something about Thomas." William Mandeville, the Earl of Essex, said, "I think a delegation of us should go to see Thomas and set him straight."
"And what will you do if he refuses to listen to reason?" said Walleran. "I think we should then arrest him in the name of the king."
Several people started to speak at once. The assembly broke up into smaller groups. Those around the Earl of Essex began to plan their deputation to Canterbury. William saw Walleran talking to two or three younger knights. Walleran caught his eye and beckoned him over. Walleran said, "William Mandeville's delegation will do no good. Thomas can handle them with one hand tied behind his back." Reginald Fitzurse gave William a hard look and said, "Some of us think the time has come for sterner measures."
"What do you mean?" William said.
"You heard what Angergay said."
Richard Lebray, a boy of about 18, blurted out, "Execution!" The word chilled William's heart. It was serious then. He stared at Walleran. "Will you ask for the king's blessing?" Reginald answered,
"Impossible. He can't sanction something like this in advance." He grinned evilly, "but he can reward his faithful servants afterward."
Young Richard said, "Well, William, are you with us?"
"I'm not sure," William said.
He felt both excited and scared.
"I'll have to think about it."
Reginald said, "There's no time to think. We'll have to go now. We must get to Canterbury before William Mandeville, otherwise his lot will get in the way." Walleran addressed William.
"They need an older man with them, to guide them and plan the operation."
William was desperately keen to agree. Not only would this solve all his problems, the king would probably give him an earldom for it.
"But to kill an archbishop must be a terrible sin," he said.
"Don't worry about that," Walleran said. "I'll give you absolution."
The enormity of what they were going to do hung over William like a thundercloud as the group of assassins travelled to England. He could think of nothing else. He could neither eat nor sleep. He acted confused and spoke distractedly. By the time the ship reached Dover, he was ready to abandon the project. They reached Saltwood Castle in Kent 3 days after Christmas, on a Monday evening. The castle belonged to the Archbishop of Canterbury, but during the exile it had been occupied by Ranulf de Broc, who had refused to give it back. Indeed, one of Thomas's complaints to the Pope was that King Henry had failed to restore the castle to him. Ranulf put new heart into William. Ranulf had ravaged Kent in the absence of the Archbishop, relishing the lack of authority, rather in the way William had in years gone by, and he was willing to do anything to retain the freedom to do as he pleased. He was enthusiastic about the assassination plan, and welcomed the chance of taking part, and he immediately began to discuss the details with gusto. His matter-of-fact approach dispelled the fog of superstitious dread that had clouded William's vision. William began once again to imagine how it would be if he were an earl again, with no one to tell him what to do. They stayed up most of the night, planning the operation. Ranulf drew a plan of the cathedral close and the archbishop's palace, scratching it on the table with a knife. The monastic buildings were on the north side of the church, which was unusual. They were normally to the south, as at Kingsbridge. The archbishop's palace was attached to the northwest corner of the church. It was entered from the kitchen courtyard. While they worked on the plan, Ranulf sent riders to his garrisons at Dover, Rochester, and Bletchingley, ordering his knights to meet him on the road to Canterbury in the morning. Toward dawn, the conspirators went to bed to catch an hour or two of sleep. William's legs hurt like fire after the long journey. He hoped this was the last military operation he would ever do. He would be 55 soon, if his calculations were right, and he was getting too old for it. Despite his weariness and the heartening influence of Ranulph, he still could not sleep. The idea of killing an archbishop was too terrifying. Even though he had already been absolved of his sin, he was afraid that if he went to sleep, he would have nightmares. They had figured out a good plan of attack. It would go wrong, of course. There was always something that went wrong. The important thing was to be flexible enough to cope with the unexpected. But whatever happened, it would not be very difficult for a group of professional fighting men to overpower a handful of effeminate monks. The dim light of a grey winter morning leaked into the room through the arrow-slit windows. After a while, William got up. He tried to say his prayers, but he could not. The others were up early, too. They had breakfast together in the hall. As well as William and Ranulph, there were Reginald Fitzurse, whom William had made leader of the attack group, Richard Lebray, the youngster of the group, William Tracy the oldest, and Hugh Morville, the highest ranking. They put on their armour and set out on Ranulph's horses. It was a bitterly cold day, and the sky was dark with low grey clouds, as if it might snow. They followed the old road called Stone Street. On the 2.5-hour journey they picked up several more knights. Their main rendezvous was at St. Augustine's Abbey, outside the city. The abbot was an old enemy of Thomas's, Ranulph had assured William, but nevertheless William decided to tell him that they had come to arrest Thomas, not to kill him. That was a pretense they would keep up until the last moment. No one was to know the true aim of the operation except for William himself, Ranulph, and the four knights who had crossed from France. They reached the abbey at noon. The men Ranulph had summoned were waiting. The abbot gave them dinner. His wine was very good, and they all drank plenty. Ranulph briefed the men-at-arms who would surround the cathedral close and prevent anyone from escaping. William kept shivering, even when he stood beside the fire in the guest-house. It should be a simple operation, but the penalty for failure would probably be death. The king would find a way to justify the murder of Thomas, but he could never support the attempted murder. He would have to deny all knowledge of it and hang the perpetrators. William had hanged many people as Sheriff of Shiring, but the thought of his own body dangling at the end of a rope still made him shake. He turned his mind to the thought of the earldom he could expect as a reward for success. It would be nice to be an earl again in his old age, respected and deferred to and obeyed without question. Perhaps Aliena's brother Richard would die in the Holy Land, and King Henry would give William his old estates again. The thought warmed him more than the fire. When they left the abbey they were a small army. Nevertheless, they had no trouble getting into Canterbury. Ranulph had controlled this part of the country for 6 years, and he had not yet relinquished his authority. He held more sway than Thomas, which was no doubt why Thomas had complained so bitterly to the Pope. As soon as they were inside, the men-at-arms spread out around the cathedral close and blocked all the exits. The operation had begun. Until this moment, it had been theoretically possible to call the whole thing off with no harm done. But now, William thought with a shiver of dread, the die was cast. He left Ranulph in charge of the blockade, keeping a small group of knights and men for himself. He installed most of the knights in a house opposite the main gateway to the cathedral close. Then he went through the gate with the remainder. Reginald Fitzurse and the other three conspirators rode into the kitchen courtyard as if they were official visitors, rather than armed intruders. But William ran into the gatehouse and held the terrified porter at sword point. The attack was underway. With his heart in his mouth, William ordered a man-at-arms to tie up the porter, then summoned the rest of his men into the gatehouse and closed the gate. Now no one could enter or leave. He had taken armed control of a monastery. He followed the four conspirators into the kitchen courtyard. There were stables to the north of the yard, but the four had tied their horses to a mulberry tree in the middle. They took off their sword belts and helmets. They would keep up the facade of a peaceful visit a little longer. William caught up with them and dropped his weapons under the tree. Reginald looked inquiringly at him. "All's well," William said. "The place is isolated." They crossed the courtyard to the palace and went into the porch. William assigned a local knight called Richard to stay in the porch on guard. The others entered the great hall. The palace servants were sitting down to dinner. That meant they had already served Thomas and the priests and monks who were with him. One of the servants stood up. Reginald said, "We are the king's men." The room went quiet, but the servant who had stood up said, "Welcome, my lords. I am the steward of the hall, William Fitzneil. Please come in. Would you like some dinner?" He was remarkably friendly, William thought, considering that his master was at loggerheads with the king. He could probably be suborned. "No dinner, thank you," said Reginald. "A cup of wine after your journey." "We have a message for your master from the king," Reginald said impatiently. "Please announce us right away." "Very good." The steward bowed. They were unarmed, so he had no reason to refuse them. He left the table and walked to the far end of the hall. William and the four knights followed. The eyes of the silent servants went with them. William was trembling the way he used to before a battle, and he wished the fighting would start, for he knew he would be all right then. They all went up a staircase to the upper floor. They emerged in a roomy attendance chamber with benches around the sides. There was a large throne in the middle of one wall. Several black-robed priests and monks were sitting on the benches, but the throne was empty. The steward crossed the room to an open door. "Messengers from the king, my lord archbishop," he said in a loud voice. There was no audible reply, but the archbishop must have nodded, for the steward waved them in. The monks and priests stared wide-eyed as the knights marched across the room and went into the inner chamber. Thomas Becket was sitting on the edge of the bed, dressed in his archbishop's robes. There was only one other person in the room, a monk, sitting at Thomas's feet, listening. William caught the monk's eye, and was jolted to recognize Prior Philip of Kingsbridge. What was he doing here? Currying favor, no doubt. Philip had been elected Bishop of Kingsbridge, but he had not yet been confirmed. Now, William thought with savage glee, he never would be. Philip was equally startled to see William. However, Thomas carried on speaking, pretending not to notice the knights. This was a piece of calculated discourtesy, William thought. The knights sat down on the low stools and benches around the bed. William wished they had not. It made the visit seem social, and he felt they had lost impetus somehow. Perhaps that was what Thomas had intended. Finally, Thomas looked at them. He did not rise to greet them. He knew them all except William, and his eye came to rest on Hugh Morville, the highest ranking. "Ah, Hugh," he said. William had put Reginald in charge of this part of the operation, and so it was Reginald, not Hugh, who spoke to the archbishop. "We come from the king in Normandy. Do you want to hear his message in public or in private?" Thomas looked irritably from Reginald to Hugh and back again, as if he resented dealing with a junior member of the delegation. He sighed, then said, "Leave me, Philip." Philip stood up and walked past the knights, looking worried. "But don't close the door," Thomas called after him. When Philip had gone out, Reginald said, "I require you in the name of the king to go to Winchester to answer charges against you." William had the satisfaction of seeing Thomas go pale. "So that's how it is," the archbishop said quietly. He looked up. The steward was hovering at the door. "Send everyone in," Thomas said to him. "I want them all to hear this." The monks and priests filed in, Prior Philip among them. Some sat down and others stood around the walls. William had no objection. On the contrary, the more people who were present, the better. For the object of this unarmed encounter was to establish before witnesses that Thomas refused to comply with a royal command. When they were all settled, Thomas looked at Reginald. "Again," he said, "I require you in the name of the king to go to Winchester to answer charges against you." Reginald repeated. "What charges?" Thomas said quietly. "Treason." Thomas shook his head. "I will not be put on trial by Henry," he said calmly. "I've committed no crime, God knows." "You've excommunicated royal servants." "It was not I, but the Pope, who did that." "You've suspended other bishops." "I've offered to reinstate them on merciful terms. They have refused. My offer remains open."
You threatened the succession to the throne by disparaging the coronation of the king's son. I did no such thing. The Archbishop of York has no right to crown anyone, and the Pope has reprimanded him for his effrontery. But no one has suggested that the coronation is invalid.
Reginald said exasperatedly, "The one thing follows from the other, you damn fool."
"I've had enough," Thomas said. "And we've had enough of you, Thomas Becket," Reginald shouted. "By God's wounds, we've had enough of you, and your arrogance and troublemaking and treason!"
Thomas stood up.
"The Archbishop's castles are occupied by the king's men," he shouted. "The Archbishop's rents have been collected by the king. The Archbishop has been ordered not to leave the city of Canterbury, and you tell me that you have had enough?"
One of the priests tried to intervene, saying to Thomas, "My lord, let's discuss the matter in private."
"To what end?"
Thomas snapped. "They demand something I must not do and will not do." The shouting had attracted everyone in the palace, and the doorway to the chamber was crowded with wide-eyed listeners, William saw. The argument had gone on long enough. Nobody could now deny that Thomas had refused a royal command. William made a signal to Reginald. It was a discreet gesture, but Prior Philip noticed it and raised his eyebrows in surprise, realizing that the leader of the group was not Reginald, but William. Reginald said formally, "Archbishop Thomas, you are no longer under the king's peace and protection." He turned around and addressed the onlookers. "Clear this room," he ordered. Nobody moved. Reginald said, "You monks, I order you in the name of the king to guard the archbishop and prevent his escape." They would do no such thing, of course, nor did William want them to. On the contrary, he wanted Thomas to attempt an escape, for that would make it easier to kill him. Reginald turned to the steward, William Fitzneil, who was technically the archbishop's bodyguard. "I arrest you," he said. He grabbed the steward's arm and marched him out of the room. The man did not resist. William and the other knights followed them out. They ran down the stairs and through the hall. The local knight, Richard, was still on guard in the porch. William wondered what to do with the steward. He asked him, "Are you with us?" The man was terrified. He said, "Yes, if you're with the king." He was too frightened to be any danger. Whatever side he was on, William decided. He said to Richard, "Keep an eye on him. Let no one leave the building. Keep the porch door closed." With the others, he ran across the courtyard to the mulberry tree. Hastily they began to put on their helmets and swords. "We're going to do it now," William thought fearfully. "We're going to go back in there and kill the Archbishop of Canterbury. Oh, my God." It was a long time since William had worn a helmet, and the fringe of chainmail that protected the neck and shoulders kept getting in the way. He cursed his clumsy fingers. He did not have time to fumble anything just now. He spotted a boy watching him open-mouthed and shouted to him, "Hey, you! What's your name?" The boy looked back toward the kitchen, unsure whether to answer William or flee.
"Robert, Lord," he said after a moment. "They call me Robert Pipe."
"Come here, Robert Pipe, and help me with this." The boy hesitated again. William's patience ran out.
"Come here, or I swear by the blood of Jesus I'll chop off your hand with this sword."
Reluctantly, the boy came forward. William showed him how to hold up the chainmail while he put on the helmet. He got it on at last, and Robert Pipe fled. "He'll tell his grandchildren about this," William thought fleetingly. The helmet had a ventail, a mouth flap that could be pulled across and fastened with a strap. The others had closed theirs so that their faces were hidden and they could no longer be recognized. William left his open a moment longer. Each of them had a sword in one hand and an axe in the other. "Ready?" William said. They all nodded. There would be little talk from now on. No more orders were necessary, no further decisions had to be made. They were simply going to go back in there and kill Thomas. William put two fingers in his mouth and gave a shrill whistle. Then he fastened his ventail. A man-at-arms came running out of the gatehouse and threw open the main gate. The knights William had stationed in the house across the road came out and poured into the courtyard, shouting, as they had been instructed, "King's men! King's men!" William ran back to the palace. The knight Richard and the steward William Fitzneil threw open the porch door for him. As he entered,
Two of the Archbishop's servants took advantage of the fact that Richard and William Fitzneil were distracted and slammed the door between the porch and the hall. William threw his weight against the door, but he was too late. They had secured it with a bar. He cursed. A setback.